Tamiko Brown Nagin, Daniel Paul Professor of Constitutional Law and Professor of History, Harvard University. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a terrific question. It's also a complex question to answer because Brown has many meanings, and we've achieved the promise of Brown in some respects. The schools were formally desegregated, including in the South, and segregated meaningfully in many southern states for several decades. That's a great achievement. So in the Deep South, where there was the greatest resistance to the principle enunciated by the Warren Court in Brown versus Board of Education, one found by the late 1960s and certainly by the early 1970s, children who were African American and white actually going to school in the same school building. Where it gets complicated is both later on and when one thinks about school desegregation, not only in terms of students being in the same school building, but questions about whether they're in the same classes together. So that was the sort of a second generation Brown versus Board of Education kind of issue that was always a problem in school segregation, certainly in the South, but throughout the country. And now we're seeing, with Supreme Court rulings and with public opinion shifting away from support for affirmative movement of students across neighborhood lines, away from even having students of different races in the same school building. And so we're seeing concentrated poverty and race throughout the country, in the West, in the Northeast. So I would say at this moment, we're not doing very well at all in fulfilling the promises of Brown versus Board of Education. Mm-hmm. Well, in part, I will say that there is a difference between the public support for the principle of racial equality, which it's a great achievement in this country to have large majorities of people who now understand that discriminating on the basis of race, intentional discrimination, is wrong. There was a time when you couldn't get a majority of people to enunciate that principle. Now, people by and large do. The problem is that it's as if people have stopped. So they understand that nothing else constitutes racial inequality. In fact, in the last term on the Supreme Court, we saw a debate, great debate, between Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Sotomayor on precisely this point. What is racial inequality, and can the courts and legislatures try to implement remedies to address inequality when it doesn't look like the kind of inequality that we saw and the Warren Court addressed in a case like Brown versus Board of Education, or the paradigmatic example of Bull Connor and the police force in Birmingham turning their hoses on black children. So that's racial hatred. Everyone understands that. But what about social conditions that are related to race, but people don't understand them as being born of individual animus? That's where it gets complicated, really complicated. And what I'm doing in my work recently is really trying to think about ways in which institutions can focus on policies that address inequality, but the policies aren't necessarily race-conscious policies. I think we're at a point in time in this country where we really have to deal with things as they are, as opposed to things as we would like them to be. So I would like for everyone to have as nuanced and as sophisticated an understanding of race as I read about in some of the law journals or in some of the sociological journals. I would like for everyone to understand, you know, implicit bias, but not everyone understands that. So we really have to focus on policies that try to build coalitions, policies where one can achieve buy-in across large sectors of the population. And I think that's where we are. Certainly the Supreme Court in the affirmative action cases, it's nudging universities in that direction. There's still wiggle room there to use race-conscious policies, but it's nudged. In the K through 12 context, in parents involved, the Supreme Court has made it all but impossible, majority, or really disincentivize, I should say, the use of race-conscious remedies in to achieve school desegregation. So we really have to be creative and innovative in the policies that we choose. Even as we insist, we still talk about how race matters in people's lives, and it very much does matter. So to insist that we are creative in the policies that we choose to address racial inequality is not to be mistaken for saying that race doesn't matter. Race does matter. It matters for some communities and sectors more than it does for others, actually. And I think it's important to talk about all of those things. Well, some of the things that I think need to be done include focusing on the quality of education available to students, by which I mean the quality of teachers, the quality of courses, funding, really trying to have state legislators and school boards focus on inequities in the span of metropolitan areas. There are real differences, real documented differences. And, you know, there's a way in which the civil rights cases, litigation is a bit different now than it was many years ago, in that it's very much focused on empirical data, which is, from the standpoint of trying to craft remedies, can be very useful. The data shows vast disparities. And one can argue about why these disparities have come about, right? And one can have that argument outside of court or inside of court. People of goodwill can try to address those disparities, address the implements, the inputs that I think many people would have to concede make for a quality education. Those are things that can be done, but there are also ways in which, again, thinking about coalition building, universities perhaps can, in a way, promote K through 12 desegregation and equality by perhaps giving a leg up to students who attend integrated education in the university admissions process. That's something that I've heard discussed, and I think that's a very fine innovation. So in other words, again, one has to think about crafting policies that achieve wide buy-in. That is where we are now. So I am very interested in talking about social justice, corrective justice even, but at the same time, one has to think in terms of policies that will incentivize or address, rather, people's self-interest. You know, people are motivated by things that help them. And so if white middle-class folks see neighborhood schools improving, they're more likely to send their children to those schools. So those are the kinds of things that we need to focus on. Really, the kinds of things that weren't necessarily addressed during the Brown versus Board of Education era, when there was more emphasis on racial remedies. We're in a different era where, in my view, it's actually a good thing to focus on the inputs that are so badly needed to give students who, because of racial disadvantage or because of poverty, place them in a position that is different from that of the typical child from a middle-class family. We need to, as a nation, If we want to be a nation that promotes social mobility, we have to provide that opportunity for our students. And I'm happy that there are people in politics today who are talking in those terms. There's been movement in a number of areas. You know, there was the movement to talk about income inequality. I think that's helpful in the context of education. And I hope that that conversation, the ongoing conversation about the legacy of Brown versus Board of Education, the conversation that we're still having about affirmative action in higher education, which pushes back into a conversation about preparation for higher education, all of those conversations together will inspire people to continue this fight for equity in K through 12. Well, I have said on many occasions, as you know, I teach constitutional law, one thing that I have said is that there's something appealing about that formulation. So it's not that he is wrong in the impulse, an impulse that I think many people share. Certainly Justice Thomas shares this, Scalia shares this, Alito shares this, Kennedy shares this, I can go on and on. So a lot of people share the impulse that, listen, in this country, when governmental institutions have tried to draw lines, racial lines, when governmental actors in the past have taken account of race, often they've gotten it horribly wrong. So I don't think as a baseline that point of view is problematic. What's problematic is stopping there and not considering that, well, there are some circumstances, actually, where the precedent and the circumstances suggest that the de minimis use of race can be constitutional. And so I actually don't think that the colorblind baseline in the law is problematic. Indeed, that's an aspiration that I share. Formal equality is a good thing. It's that there are people who still suffer on the basis of race. There is racial inequality that, in my view, is a product of historical inequality that I think Chief Justice Roberts would agree was deeply problematic. He said as much in his decisions in the voting rights context and in the educational context. So I think where there is broad disagreement is on how to think about remedies and to what extent the precedents actually permit the use of race-conscious remedies today. Today, where it seems to a lot of people that there are many indicators that would suggest that overt racism has receded to the background enough that we can just move on. So that is how I see the problem. And I think that it is really important for those of us who care about this issue of racial inequality to reason about it, to talk about it in a way that sees those who don't necessarily share our view about remedies as people of good faith. That's really important.